It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Hong Kong protesters threaten to seize buildings and Secret Service chief resigns after serious presidential security breaches. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. Hong Kong protesters are raising the stakes in anti-government demonstrations gripping the city, warning that students will occupy government buildings if the Chinese territory's chief executive does not resign. Protesters issued their ultimatum Wednesday, saying pro-Beijing chief Long Chongying must step down by the end of the day Thursday today, or they will storm the buildings. It remained unclear early today whether the loosely knit protest groups are in full agreement on the threatened actions. The director of the U.S. Secret Service, Julia Pearson, has resigned after two major security lapses that could have put the president in danger. White House spokesman Josh Earnest Wednesday said Pearson met with President Barack Obama, who expressed appreciation for her 30 years of service to the country. Earnest said Pearson took responsibility for the service's shortcomings and for fixing them. Pearson faced tough questions from Congress this week after two serious breaches in security last month. Texas Governor Rick Perry says health officials are keeping watch on as many as 18 people who came in contact with the first patient to be diagnosed with Ebola in the United States.
Today we learned that some school-aged children have been identified as having had contact with the patient and are now being monitored at home for any signs of the disease.
Ambulance workers who brought the patient to the hospital have tested negative for the Ebola virus. This is VOA News. U.S. President Barack Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met at the White House Wednesday with polite but firm remarks on contentious Middle East issues. It was their first face-to-face talk since Israel's war with Hamas militants in Gaza in July and August left more than 2,100 Palestinians dead, mostly civilians. Mr. Obama said Israel and the Palestinians have to find ways to change the status quo to resolve issues that led to the fighting.
We have to find ways to change the status quo so that both Israeli citizens are safe in their own homes and school children in their schools from the possibility of rocket fire, but also that we don't have the tragedy of Palestinian children being killed as well.
Mr. Netanyahu praised the U.S. leader for unflinching support during the conflict, but said the possibility of Iran developing a nuclear weapon is even more critical. The Israeli leader said he fervently hopes the United States will not lift sanctions against Tehran. At least 10 people were killed Wednesday when shells hit near a school and a minibus in eastern Ukraine's rebel-held city of Donetsk. 4 people were killed when a shell exploded just a few meters from the building on what was the first day of classes for students in the area. No children were injured in the shelling, but a teacher and a parent of a student were among the casualties. The Donetsk Regional Administration blamed the incident on pro-Russian separatists, while the rebels said the shelling came from positions held by government troops. In a separate incident, a shell hit a public minibus, killing 6 people. The Donetsk City Council reported later Wednesday that residents in the city's Kivyevsky district had been killed and wounded in continued heavy shelling, did not provide casualty figures. Following widespread criticism, Indonesia's President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono says he will replace a controversial new law that would end the direct election of local officials. The president on Wednesday announced he will issue a decree that will replace the measure passed last week by the parliament. He said after listening to the people, he decided to reestablish direct local elections with some modifications, but it's not yet clear what those modifications will be. A Somali-American man who has been sentenced to 30 years in prison for plotting to bomb a Christmas tree lighting ceremony in the western U.S. state of Oregon nearly 4 years ago. The man, a naturalized U.S. citizen, was a student at Oregon State University. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, and this is VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The Liberian man diagnosed as the first Ebola patient in the United States apparently had contact with school children.
Today we learned that some school-aged children have been identified as having had contact with the patient and are now being monitored at home for any signs of the disease.
That's Texas Governor Rick Perry speaking Wednesday at a news conference. We'll talk with the leader of the Liberian community in Dallas, Texas. Nigeria celebrated its 54th independence anniversary yesterday amid security challenges. And a human rights campaigner says Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has a legal obligation to appear before the ICC next week.
President Kenyatta, as an accused before the International Criminal Court, has an obligation to obey and follow the orders the judges issue.
Richard Dacre is the director of the International Justice Program at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. A South Sudan rebel official said his side is open to investigation for allegations of atrocities. And Bambari Hospital plays a vital role in the violent plague at Central African Republic. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Liberian man diagnosed with the first Ebola case in the United States has been identified as Thomas Eric Dunkey and is in isolation in a Dallas hospital. He was listed as serious but stable condition on Wednesday. Texas Governor Rick Perry told a news conference that health officials are keeping watch on as many as 18 people who came in contact with Mr. Dunkey. They include five school children.
As you know, a patient was admitted to this hospital on September the 28th, subsequently tested positive for Ebola. Today, we learned that some school-aged children have been identified as having had contact with the patient and are now being monitored at home for any signs of the disease. I know that parents are being extremely concerned about that development, but let me assure these children have been identified and they are being monitored, and the disease cannot be transmitted before having any symptoms. Public health investigators from Dallas County and from the Texas Department of State Health Services are working to identify, to locate, and monitor the health of all of those who have come into close contact with the patient. I have full confidence in the medical professionals, in our local, our state, and our federal partners in keeping this contained. This is a disease that is not airborne and is substantially more difficult to contract than the common cold. We have experts here with us today who will be talking to you in a minute about the precautions that you may want to take. The medical community of North Texas, along with officials from the state and federal government, have been working together to take every step available and necessary to care for this patient's health and to ensure the safety and welfare of our citizens. There are few places in the world better equipped to meet the challenge that is posed in this case. Texas is one of only 13 states certified by the CDC to conduct diagnostic Ebola testing. And we have the healthcare professionals and the institutions that are second to none. The public should have every confidence that the highly trained professionals involved here will succeed in this very important mission.
That was Texas Governor Rick Perry speaking Wednesday at a news conference in Dallas, Texas. The president of the Liberian community of Dallas, Stanley Gay, says the community is praying for Mr. Duncan and all those he may have come in contact with.
Well, we don't have much of information. We are still working to find out who this person is. His name has not been released. But we're trying to work within the community to find out who that person is to, you know, let the community know so we can give them our support and have we are praying for them. But as of now, we don't have that information on hand.
And so far, do you know where he comes from Liberia, where in the country?
No, not yet. I don't know which part of Liberia they came from. But I know from what I've heard so far, he was here visiting family members.
So you're 100% sure he's a Liberian person, right?
Yes, I'm 100% sure that he is a Liberian.
And how do you feel about that? Because, you know, we've been following the story for months. It's in Liberia, Guinea, Sierra Leone, you know, in West Africa, and now it's in the U.S. How do you feel about it?
All I feel is it is mind-boggling. We didn't expect it to come to our city dollars. But again, we have to be mindful and just let our community know not to look at this as a stigma. Those that have been in contact with this individual, we ask that they reach out to the CDC or any hospital to make sure they have been, to make sure they be tested and not to be ashamed of it.
And you, so far, are you trying to reach every member of the community to see who might have been in contact with this person?
We're reaching out. Matter of fact, we are putting our press release out that pretty soon we're going to update our webpage to put a press release out. And we are sending emails to our Liberian community, text to them that if they have been in contact with this individual, anybody know of this individual, you know, if you don't want a name come up, they should take that, be responsible and report themselves to the proper care.
And are you concerned that so far you don't know who is this person?
Yeah, it's a big concern because you don't know who they have been in contact with, who you have been around with, because we as Liberians, we all gather together and we have a close knit. We are being together. So it is a concern for each and every person within the United States, in Texas, in Dallas. So it's a big concern because we need to know. The sooner we know, the better we can prepare ourselves.
Stanley Gay is president of the Liberian community in Dallas, Texas. He was speaking with VOA's Nicholas Pinot. Nigeria's military says it has made significant strides in reducing attacks by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram against unarmed civilians in parts of the country. Mike O'Meary is director general of the National Orientation Agency, which also handles the government's information on Boko Haram. In this interview with reporter Peter Clarty, O'Meary cited President Barack Obama's Independence Day message to the government and people of Nigeria, promising support in the fight against terrorism.
There has been consistent attempts at attacking some communities in the northeast, especially Konduga up to Maiduguri area. But the armed forces of Nigeria have successfully repelled those attacks and to large extent even conquered some of the facilities that the insurgents have used or have been using to attack citizens and those communities. Indeed, a number of insurgents have met their Waterloo in the Battle of Konduga. And I am optimistic that with the poise and reinforcement, retooling and skills of the armed forces now in the fight against insurgency, we would begin to witness many more of such achievements in terms of repelling the insurgents and also making sure that we stamp this aspect of inclination to killing.
What contributed to the successes that you have just enumerated by the Nigerian military?
Bravery and bravado, more equipment required are being deployed to the area, and the poise by the government to ensure that the armed forces' morale is strengthened. And the commitment by Nigerians and everyone to see that this is put behind us and forces of Nigeria are now even to do greater service to their motherland.
There were reports that foreign military expert that came to help Nigeria with this insurgency appeared to have lost confidence in the military and have left. These were local reports that I'm hearing about. Based on the successes of the Nigerian military in this fight against the insurgents, is this part of the reason why some of the military personnel who allegedly abandoned their post when they were ordered to strategically fight this fight to be prosecuted or court-martialed in this case? Is it part of the policy to ensure discipline and high morale in the military?
Before I even answer this, in relation to the last question you asked about frustrations, only yesterday, President Obama sent a message to the president, government, and people of Nigeria of their renewed determination to support the fight against insurgency in Nigeria. And I think that is a signal to those who think that foreign support has waned and people have left in frustration. This is not true.
Mike Omeri is Director General of Nigeria's National Orientation Agency. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October the 2nd. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. A human rights campaigner says Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has a legal obligation to obey the orders of judges at the International Criminal Court, the ICC, to be present at the hearing on October 8th to determine the starting date of his trial. Mr. Kenyatta is charged with crimes against humanity for allegedly orchestrating the 2007 post-election violence that resulted in the deaths of an estimated 1,000 people. Richard Dekker, director of the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch, says Mr. Kenyatta cannot use his presidential duties as an excuse.
President Kenyatta, as an accused before the International Criminal Court, has an obligation to obey and follow the orders the judges issue. So as they have done in ordering his appearance on October 8th, President Kenyatta has a legal obligation to comply with that.
President Kenyatta has said that he cannot be in The Hague on the day that he's being requested because he's going to be at a meeting, a regional meeting in Kampala. The judges don't seem to buy that. Don't you think it's very disrespectful of the fact that Kenyatta is president of Kenya?
No, I think that there are rules in place that lay out criteria for those circumstances when the judge would be excused from trial. It's up to the judges to interpret and apply those criteria. I think they have been very, very cognizant of the president's schedule in not requiring his attendance in the courtroom for some time. If I may add just to that, in terms of disrespectful, I think the president and some of those around him have been intensely disrespectful of the court that they had pledged to cooperate with when he was a presidential candidate.
Maybe I'm not a kind of a soothsayer, but I think the way I'm reading it is that if the court cannot find merit, there's not enough evidence, I'm kind of reading that they are probably going to dismiss the case. I'm speculating.
Well, I think, and I'm a human rights lawyer and believe that trials should go forward when there's sufficient evidence against the accused. And if there is not evidence against the accused, I think that raises some sharp questions about the continuation of proceedings. So if there is no evidence, it is hard to imagine a case going to trial. I think the real losers here are the victims of the horrible post-election violence that happened in 2007 and 2008.
Richard Dekker is the director of the International Justice Program at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. He was speaking with me from New York City. It is not clear if President Kenyatta would appear in person next week at the ICC or not, but if he does, he will be the first sitting head of state to do so. Kenyatta spokesman Manoa Esipisu reportedly said the president had no reaction yet to the court's order. David Nyakorash Masanga of the Pan-African Forum and a staunch anti-ICC advocate says the court has no case against President Kenyatta and will most likely dismiss the charges comes October 8th.
Let me tell you frankly, we shall come back victorious. I've followed this case, James. There is nothing in this case. This case is hollow. This case is empty. This case has no evidence. It is unfair for the chief prosecutor to hold a suspect for time and time forever. Yet there is no evidence. So the judges have to, no alternative. They have no alternative. They cannot extend this uncertainty until God comes back to tell us when the evidence will be got. The government of the Republic of Kenya said there is no evidence. So I personally believe in my heart, and I have a feeling that the judges want to terminate this case.
David Nyako Rush Masanga of the Pan-African Forum and a staunch anti-ICC advocate. He was speaking with me from Nairobi, Kenya. A senior South Sudan rebel official says his group will do everything to make sure that anyone found to have committed atrocities during the conflict in his country will be held accountable, whether they are rebel or government fighters. Bonifacio Taban of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Both rebel and government force have been accused of committing atrocity during the conflict in South Sudan, including ethnical targeting, killings, sexual abuse, looting and destruction of properties. But Oyet Nasinin Ferino, head of the SPLM National Committee for Political Mobilization, denied his side was responsible for killing hundreds of civilians in Bentiu in April or elsewhere.
We support justice and accountability. We support the investigation. We want those who will be found responsible for the crimes against humanity, war crimes, crimes of genocide in South Sudan must be prosecuted.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, accused opposition force at carrying out targeted killing in Bentiu in April when they captured the United States capital from government troops. UNMISS say the rebel unarmed and killed people who had sought shelter in hospitals, churches, and mosques. The UN also accused the rebel of inciting vengeful sexual violence against us. Ferino say the SPLM in opposition, the rebel official name, welcomed the African Union Commission of Inquiry. He said the rebel would welcome an investigation by the International Criminal Court into alleged war crime in South Sudan. At a final discussion held last week by the UN Human Rights Commission, former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, who aided the African Union Commission of Inquiry for South Sudan, said he has a quote, no doubt that there have been gross violations of human rights in South Sudan and that they have been committed by both sides. The Commission of Inquiry has met with both sides in the conflict, with civil society groups, refugees and internal displaced persons. Mr. Obasanjo did not say when the Commission will submit its final report. He hoped his team finding will, quote, make impunity things of the past in South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Boniface Taban, reporting from Kampala.
In the Central African Republic, almost 2 years of conflict has left the country's second city, Bambari, without a government. The only establishment still functioning is the main hospital where doctors and nurses perform surgery on victims from recent fighting under threats from armed men. Katerina Herje has this story from Bambari Hospital.
On a rubber mattress in a simple metal frame bed, lay Ephraim Bishimbao. His head is covered in bandages. The 24-year-old suffered a machete blow to the head when fighting broke out at the Seleka rebel-controlled checkpoint. The rebels wouldn't let women pass. I went to check on the situation, says Bishimbao. He arrived here just 2 days ago after spending 11 days traveling by road and river to reach the region's only functioning hospital. I was hiding in the bush when a group of fishermen found me and brought me here, he says. Tit-for-tat violence between Seleka rebels and anti-Balaka militias has devastated entire villages, displaced thousands and left countless dead and wounded. The hospital's already inadequate resources are strained beyond the limit. The operating room and a maternity ward are only functioning with the assistance of the International Red Cross and the global charity Save the Children. Pain medication is in short supply, making surgery an ordeal. Dr. Joseph Bauma, born and raised in Bambari, where his father was a doctor before him, says attacks on civilians are on the rise in recent months. On one day in September, the hospital received 61 wounded from one village alone. A few weeks later, 31 patients arrived from another village. Dr. Bauma says those that do make it to the hospital have survived incredible odds.
La seule administration qui marche ici à Bambari, c'est l'hôpital. La mairie ne marche pas.
Men, women and children hide in the bush for days before they seek care for bullet wounds and machete cuts, Dr. Bauma says. As if the situation wasn't tough enough, hospital staff have the added stress of working under the threat from attack. Dr. Bama says armed men, mainly from the Seleka rebels, regularly enter the hospital.
Ils rentrent régulièrement ici à l'hôpital avec leurs armes. Nous avons toujours travaillé sous pression.
He says at one point we had to hide a man who had suffered a gunshot wound in a maternity ward. The man was a member of the militia, the anti-Balaka, and the Seleka came looking for him. Treating trauma cases from the violence is a constant, making medical care for illness even tougher. The leading cause of death in the Waka region, where Bambari is the capital, is not the continuing violence, but malaria. Despite these near impossible conditions, Dr. Bama says the hospital staff is determined to stay open.
La majorité sont des hommes. La majorité sont des hommes. Soit par arme blanche,
in a region where there is very little political authority, says Bama, the hospital is one reminder that the country still exists. Katerina Höje for VA News in Bambari.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsor here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Second half goals scored by Ngong, Mani and Nchut Njoya handed Cameroon a 2-0 victory over their hosts Zambia in a women's friendly match in Lusaka on Wednesday. Both sides used the encounter as a build-up to the Telecom and Namibia Africa Women's Championships due to start in Windhoek, Namibia next week. Today, Thursday, Ivory Coast play Algeria in Windhoek. In Egypt, the Confederation of African Football has dismissed a petition by Uganda to disqualify Zambia for allegedly fielding overage players in the Africa Under-17 Championship qualifier. According to CAF, the Ugandan football authorities claimed that the Zambian captain Patso Ndaka, Changwe Kalalwe, Pumlo Siwanga and Enoch Mwepu, who played in the Zambia qualifier against Uganda, were over the age limit for the Under-17 event. Zambia beat Uganda 4-1 on aggregate to qualify for the 2015 Africa Under-17 Championships due in Niamey, Niger. Staying in Cairo, Kenya has submitted to the Confederation of African Football a solo bid to stage the 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. This contrasts with the earlier reports that Kenya aimed to present a joint East African bid with Rwanda, Tanzania and Uganda. CAF opened the bidding process for the 2017 Nations Cup after Libya withdrew owing to the deteriorated security environment in the country. In Nigeria, the newly elected Nigeria Football Federation President Amaju Pinnage has reiterated that his NFF board is committed to seeing Nigeria Super Eagles qualify for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. Pinnage told the Lagos media on Wednesday that the new NFF board is urgently working on resolving the question of whether Stephen Keshi will be retained as the coach of the African champions Nigeria Super Eagles. The unstable climate in the NFF after the FIFA World Cup in July and prior to Tuesday's NFF board elections negatively affected the Super Eagles' quest to qualify for the Nations Cup, let alone play like defending champions in the two group qualifiers against the Republic of Congo and South Africa last month. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Texas Governor Rick Perry says health officials are keeping watch on as many as 18 people who came in contact with the first patient to be diagnosed with Ebola in the United States. That's it for this Thursday, October 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouman, I'm James Butter saying have a good Thursday.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.